Hello, this is Barbara, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the October 7th issue of the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Supreme Court returns to face Trump tests of presidential power. As the justices return to the bench Monday, the court will confront a series of cases central to the president's agenda. When the nine justices of the Supreme Court return to their raised mahogany bench each year on the first Monday of October, it typically marks the end of a three-month stretch of rest and reflection. But this summer's traditional recess was anything but a cooling-off period. Instead, the justices churned through emergency requests from the Trump administration that sharply divided the court along ideological lines and a reflection of how much President Trump's agenda has consumed their calendar. The president's policies will have an even more central role in the term that begins on Monday, after the justices agree to take three cases with broad consequences for his agenda. In November, they will hear arguments about the legality of Mr. Trump's sweeping tariffs, a centerpiece of his trade strategy. In December, they will consider Mr. Trump's efforts to wrest control of independent agencies, and in January, his attempt to fire a member of the Federal Reserve Board. By the time the term ends in June, there could be others. Already, the administration has asked the court to take up a pair of cases testing the legality of the president's executive order ending birthright citizenship, an issue that raises fundamental questions about what it means to be an American. The result will be a term of generational consequence for the court and the presidency, and a defining one for the legacy of Chief Justice John Roberts, who will mark his 20th year on the bench. It's hard to imagine bigger tests of presidential power than these potentially once-in-a-century separation of powers battles, said Deepak Gupta, a lawyer at the firm Gupta Wessler, who frequently argues cases before the justices. And we're seeing more than one of them at once. Since Mr. Trump took office in January, the court's conservative majority has repeatedly sided with the administration. But those decisions came in a series of emergency, unsigned orders, often published without reasoning on what critics call the shadow docket. The orders have technically been temporarily addressing whether a challenged policy could be implemented while its legality was tested in court. But until now, the justices have not squarely addressed the legality of Mr. Trump's boundary-pushing policies to transform the government. That will change this term as the justices confront Mr. Trump's policies head-on, offering final judgments on whether they are legal in cases that include oral arguments and decisions with lengthy options. We're going to see, among other things, whether the Supreme Court is actually going to say no to Donald Trump on anything, said Pamela S. Carlin, a co-director of Stanford Law School's Supreme Court Litigation Clinic and former Justice Department official in the Obama and Biden administrations. They've tried to dodge and tried to dodge and tried to dodge, saying no to him by coming up with procedural ways to say yes to him, Miss Carlin said, but I don't see how they get out of this term doing it that way. Apart from administration's cases testing the limits of executive authority, the court will hear a series of other consequential matters, including more politically charged legal battles over gender identity. Last term, the court divided along ideological lines when it allowed Tennessee to prohibit some medical treatments for transgender youths. On Tuesday, the justices will consider a challenge from a Christian therapist who objected to a Colorado law prohibiting licensed mental health therapists from counseling minors to change their sexual orientation or gender identity. The court will also hear legal challenges to state laws barring transgender athletes from girls' and women's sports teams. Major cases that could reshape the election landscape are also on the docket, including one that could result in the justices striking down or severely restraining a key part of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. That case involves a challenge to Louisiana's voting map, which was adopted following the 2020 census and includes two majority black congressional districts. The justices heard a challenge to the map in the spring. Rather than rule on whether state lawmakers unlawfully emphasized race in drawing the map, as some non-black residents had argued, the justices announced that they would hear the case again with a more expansive constitutional question. The rare move suggested that some members of the court might be ready to use the case to gut the Voting Rights Act, a pillar of the civil rights era that conservatives have been whittling down in recent years. The justices this week will also hear a challenge to rules on mail-in ballots in Illinois, a case that could open the way for efforts to restrict voting by mail. And later in the term, the court will consider what could become a landmark case on campaign finance regulations, a challenge to federal guardrails that limit political parties from coordinating with candidates to spend money on campaign advertising. But the heart of the court's work this term, which by tradition will stretch into late June or early July, is likely to involve Mr. Trump. The justices have so far issued more than 20 orders in response to emergency applications involving the Trump administration, ruling overwhelmingly in Mr. Trump's favor in decisions that were technically placeholders. Their rulings have addressed preliminary questions, such as who has the right to sue and in which court. But the immediate impact of those interim orders has been significant. In recent months, the justices have allowed Mr. Trump to withhold billions of dollars in foreign aid funding, to begin dismantling the Education Department, to deport migrants to war-torn countries where they have no connections, and to kick transgender troops out of the military. While the majority's rulings are often brief, the three liberal justices have issued lengthy and impassioned dissents. Irv Gornstein, who heads the Supreme Court Institute at Georgetown Law School, said it was hard to ignore the court's overwhelming habit of dividing along ideological lines when issuing emergency orders in the Trump administration's favor. Mr. Gornstein added that if those voting patterns hold when the court reaches final decisions about the validity of the administration's policies, and with other controversial cases on its docket, we are in for one of the most polarizing terms yet. The opening months of the term feature back-to-back tests of the president's agenda. The justices have fast-tracked review of Mr. Trump's sweeping tariffs after a lower court said that the president exceeded his authority by invoking a 1970s-era emergency power to tax imports from major trading partners. The International Emergency Economic Powers Act has typically been used to impose sanctions and embargoes against other nations. It does not mention the word tariff. Some leading conservatives and libertarian scholars have said in court filings that the president's use of the statute to impose tariffs was unlawful and that the power to tax must remain with Congress. If the justices agree with the lower courts that Mr. Trump improperly invoked the act, the president will be forced to remove that set of tariffs. But the administration is already issuing tariffs under other legal provisions. In December, the court will examine the president's power to fire a leader of the Federal Trade Commission, revisiting a 90-year precedent that has allowed Congress to pass laws preventing presidents from removing independent regulators solely over policy disagreements. Even before Mr. Trump returned to office, the Supreme Court's conservative majority had taken steps to make it easier for presidents to remove independent agency leaders, signaling it would be receptive to claims of executive power. In January, the court will consider whether Mr. Trump can remove Lisa Cook, a Federal Reserve Board governor. The justices have signaled in a separate case that the Fed is uniquely independent, and their decision will have far-reaching implications for the central bank and the U.S. economy. Steve Vladeck, a professor at Georgetown Law School, cautioned against reading too much into the Supreme Court's preliminary orders. Only in this term, he said, will the justices show whether they plan to curb Mr. Trump's expansion of executive power. That's why this term is so important. Plenty of folks think that question has already been answered, but the conclusive evidence is still to come, Mr. Vladeck said. Jonathan Adler, a law professor at William & Mary who specializes in administrative and constitutional law, said that one reason Mr. Trump had been so successful at the court so far was that his lawyers had been able to cherry-pick which cases to bring to the justices, largely avoiding some of the thornier disputes. The result, he said, was an unrepresentative sample. The rulings so far don't really tell us how the court views the substance of what the administration has been planning, he said. Chief Justice Roberts, this term, will become the fourth longest serving chief in the court's history. A student of history, he is an admirer of the longest serving chief justice in American history, John Marshall, who avoided issuing rulings that would provoke direct confrontations with President Thomas Jefferson, a model he will now have to decide whether to emulate. He will preside over a court with members who appear to be growing more restless. Throughout the summer, in appearances at judicial conferences and book talks, the justices aired disagreements over how the court was handling the president's many requests, including how much the court should explain itself to the public and lower court judges. Tensions among the justices have also spilled out in their emergency rulings, in which the court's liberals have sometimes included sharp words as their colleagues have cleared the way for the president's agenda. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, in particular, has pointedly criticized her conservative colleagues, characterizing one ruling in July as not only truly unfortunate, but also hubristic and senseless. Justice Sonia Sotomayor suggested in a separate dissent in July that the majority was giving special treatment to Mr. Trump, writing that the administration has the Supreme Court on speed dial. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Canon Shanmugam, who regularly argues cases before the court, said the bench that Chief Justice Roberts joined in 2005 was made up of justices who appeared more interested in the court's institutional reputation. I think the Chief Justice is very much in that vein, but he doesn't have a lot of partners right now in that regard, said Mr. Shanmugam, who was a clerk to Justice Antonin Scalia. The challenge the Chief Justice has going forward is in managing this somewhat more individualistic and somewhat more fractious group of colleagues. Pakistan fights its fiercest Taliban insurgency in a decade. Pakistan uprooted the Taliban with U.S. help in the 2010s, but the insurgency has resurfaced with assistance from the Afghan Taliban. In the rugged mountains of Pakistan, the resurgent Pakistani Taliban are waging a relentless and deadly guerrilla war against Pakistani security forces in the biggest terrorism threat the South Asian nation has faced in a dozen years. Pakistan has responded to the insurgency, which was nearly defunct just 4 years ago, with drone strikes and what it has called targeted operations. But in the process, the military has lost hundreds of armed personnel, displaced tens of thousands of people, and stoked anger among local communities. Pakistan's shaky grip on its mountainous western regions along the border of Afghanistan is compounded by the presence of Islamic State fighters in the same areas. The increasing militant activity has threatened Pakistan's positioning as a military powerhouse in South Asia, a status that it has been taking measures to consolidate this year. Pakistan's powerful army chief, General Syed Asim Manir, met President Trump at the White House last month, their second meeting in just over 3 months. The Pakistani military downed Indian jets with Chinese technology earlier this year, and Pakistan's government signed a defense pact with Saudi Arabia last month. Yet, the Pakistani Taliban have presented Pakistan with its fiercest security challenge in years, security analysts say. Since the Taliban took power in Afghanistan in 2021, the Pakistani Taliban, known as Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, or TTP, have grown into a powerful and well-structured group. The leadership has received financial support from the Taliban-run government in Afghanistan, and its fighters have trained and retreated freely across the border, according to Pakistani military officials and independent and United Nations experts. The Taliban in Afghanistan deny backing the Pakistani group. The Pakistan Taliban have been able to assert themselves, and the balance of power is starting to lean against Pakistan's security forces, said Esfandiar Mir, a senior fellow in the South Asia program at the Stimson Center in Washington. As TTP operations have grown more sophisticated, the group has more often targeted Pakistani police and soldiers instead of civilians, though regular people are still routinely caught in the crossfire. On Thursday, the group claimed responsibility for a car bomb explosion that killed at least 10 people on Tuesday, most of them civilians outside the regional headquarters of a paramilitary force. Terrorist attacks in Pakistan surged last year to their highest levels since 2015, driven largely by TTP operations, according to the PAC Institute for Peace Studies, a research center. The attacks have made Pakistan the second most affected country by terrorism, according to a global terrorism index. In response, the Pakistani military launched a large-scale offensive this summer in the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa region, a province that borders Afghanistan and where the Taliban have mostly been operating. The military has claimed the killing of militants every few days. But isolated communities, already scarred by hundreds of U.S. drone strikes a decade ago, and the subsequent Pakistani military campaign that uprooted the militants and pushed them into Afghanistan, have once again been caught in the middle of armed conflict. Tens of thousands of people have been displaced since the beginning of the year. The military operation has been contained to a few districts for now, but local leaders and security experts fear it will spread throughout Khyber Pakhtunkhwa as it did in the early 2010s. The district of Bajar at the border with Afghanistan has become the center of the ongoing conflict in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa. Local communities have been fleeing their homes as the Pakistani military fights with the Pakistani Taliban. Schools have been converted into shelters. The desks once lined in neat rows now stacked against the walls to make space for families uprooted by the fighting. Every time the government starts an operation and displaces us, militants cross back into Afghanistan and later return, Abdul Rahim, a street hawker, said recently from a classroom. The TTP was created in 2007 as a reaction to Pakistani support of the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. An alliance of militant groups, it implemented Sharia law in what were then tribal areas, subject to colonial era regulations, and launched attacks on Pakistani security forces as well as foreign troops in Afghanistan. TTP militants indiscriminately targeted universities, religious leaders, and civilian targets, including in Pakistan's largest cities and abroad, with an attempted Times Square bombing in New York. But a combination of military operations, U.S. drone attacks that killed key militant leaders, and rifts within the group left the Pakistan Taliban weakened. In 2018, Pakistan declared victory over the group and incorporated Khyber Pakhtunkhwa and what had been known as the federally administered tribal areas into the country's provincial framework, with a pledge to bring economic growth and curb violence. The promises have sounded hollow for many across the territories. Strengthened by the Taliban's return to power in Afghanistan in 2021, the TTP has since consolidated splinter forces, absorbed Al-Qaeda's local affiliates, and escalated attacks in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa using drones and American-made weapons and equipment abandoned in Afghanistan, including sniper rifles and night goggles. The group is also seeking to expand its influence into Punjab, Pakistan's most populous, prosperous, and politically powerful province. TTP has become more focused on direct clashes and attacks on military forces, said Pearl Pandya, an analyst at Armed Conflict Location and Event Data, which collects information on conflicts around the world. Pakistan has tried to avoid a full-scale military operation, but has also been unwilling to engage with local grievances, Ms. Pandya added. Its preferred approach of temporary, localized operations is unlikely to be successful in the long term. The permissive environment the Pakistani Taliban enjoyed in Afghanistan has infuriated Pakistani officials who have accused the Afghan Taliban of being complicit in the attacks carried out across the border. We ask for one thing. Don't allow your space to be used as a ground for destabilization inside Pakistan, Lieutenant General Hamid Sharif Qadri, the spokesman for the Pakistan Armed Forces, said about Afghanistan in an interview with the New York Times. A senior Pakistani military official, speaking on the condition of anonymity, because he wasn't authorized to discuss national security matters publicly, accused the TTP of being hand in glove with the Afghan Taliban, but acknowledged that by sparing civilians, the Pakistani Taliban had avoided widespread backlash from local communities. Officials in Afghanistan have denied the presence of armed groups in the country. The Islamic Emirate will not allow anyone to use Afghanistan's land to pose a threat to neighboring countries, the region, or the world, Hafiz Zaya Ahmad Takal, a spokesman at the Afghan Foreign Ministry, told The Times. Both Pakistani Taliban and Islamic State militants operate in Bajar, a district of nearly 1.3 million people that has faced many violent events in recent years. At least 48 drone strikes carried out by the military, the Pakistani Taliban and other groups have hit the broader Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province since the beginning of the year, the highest number in more than half a dozen years, according to armed conflict location and event data. The recent displacement has revived scenes long familiar to Bajar. Narrow mountain roads jammed with convoys of battered trucks, overloaded with bedding, cooking pots, sacks of grain, and families in haste. Many have sought refuge in schools, government offices, and private homes in safer parts of the district. Mr. Rahim, the street hawker, has had his life shadowed by conflict since U.S. forces pushed the Taliban and Al-Qaeda across the border from Afghanistan in 2001 and 2002. He was 9 when American missiles struck his village, Demadola, in 2006, targeting an Al-Qaeda leader, Ayman al-Zawahiri, but killing several civilians instead. 2 years later, his family joined tens of thousands of people fleeing Pakistan's large-scale campaign against Taliban and Al-Qaeda militants. After 8 months in displacement, we returned to find our home ruined by shelling, Mr. Rahim said. He now fears the same fate awaits him. The Pakistani military has not announced a timeline for its ongoing operation. Mr. Rahim said he did not know when he would be able to return this time, nor what condition his home might be in once he did. Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine is awarded for work on immune systems. Mary E. Brunkow, Fred Ramsdell, and Shimon Sakaguchi were awarded the prize for research showing how the body regulates its immune responses. Mary E. Brunkow, Fred Ramsdell, and Dr. Shimon Sakaguchi were awarded the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine on Monday for their discoveries of peripheral immune tolerance, the system that explains how the immune system prevents rogue cells from attacking tissues and organs. Their research, the prize committee said. He has contributed to medical advances in cancer and autoimmune treatments and may help with organ transplants. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. This is a prize I've been waiting to see, said Dr. Alexander Marson, director of the Gladstone UCSF Institute of Genomic Immunology in San Francisco. Finding a population of T cells that had been missed and that keeps the immune system in balance was central, he said, to understanding autoimmune diseases and cancers. The three researchers will split a prize of 11 million Swedish kronor, or around 1.17 million. Why did they receive the prize? Central to the scientists' research were their discoveries about T cells, the white blood cells that fight infection in the body. They identified a class of cells, regulatory T cells, and the genes that control them. In doing so, they answered puzzling biological questions. How does the immune system know to avoid attacking the body's own healthy cells? And if by mistake some immune system cells fail to get the message, how are those cells stopped from wreaking havoc? The committee called their work fundamental to understanding how the body's immune system functions. In an interview after the prize announcement, Rickard Sandberg, a professor in the Department of Cell and Molecular Biology at the Karolinska Institute in Sweden and a member of the prize committee, said that the research had provided a new handle on how to approach autoimmune disorders or treatments in organ transplants. There are more than 200 clinical trials underway that build on their research, he said. How did they make their discovery? Dr. Sakaguchi, now a distinguished professor at the University of Osaka in Japan, worked out a medical mystery involving the thymus, a small organ behind the breastbone. It sorts out immune cells that might attack the body's own tissues and organs and prevents them from getting into the bloodstream. He first studied the organ as a student in the 1970s and then performed research in the United States in the 1980s. His colleagues had done an experiment that made no sense. In the first few days after a mouse is born, the thymus is supposed to train the immune system, preventing T cells that could attack the body from ever entering the bloodstream. In this experiment, the researchers removed the thymus from mice 3 days after the animals were born. In theory, the organ should have done its job during those 3 days. Harmful T cells should never have had a chance to get to the body's tissues and organs. Instead, the opposite happened. The immune system went wild, attacking organs. But why? After more than a decade of work, Dr. Sakaguchi discovered that the thymus did not stop every harmful cell from escaping into the circulation. So even though most of those cells were blocked in the mice, enough got out to go on attacking against the body's own tissue. But he learned the thymus would have fixed that problem if it had not been removed so soon. The immune system, he discovered, has a backup system, a set of immune cells that stop mistaken attacks. It involved a new class of T cells, which he called regulatory T cells. Those mice whose thymuses were removed after 3 days had not had a chance to develop the regulatory T cells. But what genes control this system? The answer came from Dr. Brunkow and Dr. Ramsdell, working at what was then a British-owned biotechnology company outside Seattle, Celltech Chiroscience. They decided to study a strain of mice that developed a horrible autoimmune disease. Their immune systems attacked their own cells their immune system's attack on their own cells was so severe that the mice lived for only a few weeks. The mice were missing a set of genetic instructions. In a healthy individual, these tell the immune system T cells to hold off their attack when they enter the general circulatory system. After years of arduous work, the two researchers found the gene called FOXP3. It resembled others that control other genes. And in 2001, they reported that a rare autoimmune disease in humans called IPEX was the same as the disease in mice. Without FOXP3, regular T cells do not form. The body does not make T cells that tell other T cells that can attack the body's cells not to respond. This is a great recognition of the fundamental importance of distinguishing self from non-self, said John Weary, director of the Colton Center for Autoimmunity at the University of Pennsylvania. Cancers block attacks from the immune system by attracting a thicket of regulatory T cells. With the FOXP3 gene identified and its role understood, researchers can develop drugs to turn the immune system against these cancer cells. With autoimmune diseases, there is the opposite problem. Regulatory T cells are missing or defective. Using FOXP3 as a starting point, researchers are developing drugs to teach the immune system to stop its attack. Dr. Marcella Mouse, director of the Cellular Immunotherapy Program at Massachusetts General Hospital, said the work holds tremendous potential for unlocking new therapeutic avenues in medicine. The Holy Grail has been to be able to manipulate and control immunity viruses' tolerance, Dr. Mouse said. The work of these laureates unlocked the tolerance side of this equation. With the discoveries, Dr. Worry said, major sets of drugs are going into the clinic for preliminary testing in cancer and autoimmunity. Who are the laureates? Dr. Sekiguchi is an expert in immunology at the University of Osaka. He was born in the city of Nagahama, about 60 miles northeast of Kyoto. As a child, he was interested in art and philosophy, but his father, a high school teacher, encouraged him to pursue science. He enrolled in Kyoto University, where he became interested in immunology. In the 1980s, he worked as a researcher at Johns Hopkins University and Stanford University, among institutions, before returning to Japan. Dr. Brunkow joined the Institute for Systems Biology in Seattle in 2009, where she studies genomics and autoimmune diseases. She received a PhD in molecular biology from Princeton University. Dr. Ramsdell is a scientific advisor at Sonoma Biotherapeutics, a company based in San Francisco that he co-founded. He has a PhD in immunology from the University of California, Los Angeles. Before joining Sonoma Bio, he was a senior executive at several other biotech companies. What did the laureates say about winning the prize? Dr. Sekiguchi called the award a surprise and an honor at a news conference on Monday on the campus of the University of Osaka. He got the call just after returning from a conference. I really was elated, he said in an interview posted on NobelPrize.org. When Dr. Sekiguchi began his work, it was difficult to obtain funding. Shigeru Ishiba, Japan's prime minister, called into the news conference and asked him why he had persisted on his research despite initial doubts about his theories. "I think my stubbornness led to these results," Dr. Sakaguchi replied. Dr. Brunkow said she did not expect to win a Nobel Prize. "My phone rang and I saw a number from Sweden and thought, well, that's just a spam of some sort. So I disabled the phone and went back to sleep," she said in an interview also posted on NobelPrize.org. Who won the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine in 2024? Victor Ambros and Gary Rovkin were recognized for the discovery of microRNA, a tiny class of RNA molecules that play a crucial role in determining how organisms mature and function and how they sometimes malfunction. When will the other Nobel Prizes be announced? The prize for physiology or medicine is the first of six Nobel Prizes that will be awarded this year. Each award recognizes groundbreaking contributions by an individual or organization in a specific field. The Nobel Prize in Physics will be awarded on Tuesday by the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences in Stockholm. Last year, John J. Hopfield and Jeffrey E. Hinton shared the prize for work on discoveries that helped computers learn more in the way the human brain does, providing the building blocks for developments in artificial intelligence. The Nobel Prize in Chemistry will be awarded on Wednesday by the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences in Stockholm. Last year, the prize went to Demis Hassabis, John Jumper, and David Baker for work that showed the potential of artificial intelligence and other technology to predict the shape of proteins and to invent new ones. The Nobel Prize in Literature will be awarded on Thursday by the Swedish Academy in Stockholm. Last year, Han Kang, known best for her novel The Vegetarian, became the first writer from South Korea to receive the award. The Nobel Peace Prize will be awarded on Friday by the Norwegian Nobel Institute in Oslo. Last year, the Japanese organization Nihon Hidankyo, a grassroots movement of atomic bomb survivors, received the award for its efforts to achieve a world free of nuclear weapons. Last week, the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economic Sciences will be awarded on Monday by the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences in Stockholm. Last year, Daron Esmogulu, Simon Johnson, and James Robinson were honored for research into how institutions shape which countries become wealthy and prosperous, and how those structures came to exist in the first place. All of the prize announcements are streamed live by the Nobel Prize organization. Stonewall National Museum, facing deep cuts, may need a new home. The Fort Lauderdale Museum, one of the country's oldest LGBTQ institutions, is looking to its rich archives for lessons in how to survive a crisis. Here is a look inside its collection. Posters that read, "Silence equal death," from the early years of the AIDS epidemic. A pair of sneakers signed by Ellen DeGeneres, who famously announced, "Yep, I'm gay," on the cover of Time. A gavel that repealed the don't ask, don't tell policy. For more than five decades, the Stonewall National Museum, archives and library in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, has chronicled the LGBTQ community by collecting and sharing its history. But the museum, one of the country's oldest such institution, is facing a hostile political environment and a financial crisis that may force it to find another home. The organization has been hampered by recent budget shortfalls that Robert Keston, its president, attributed to President Trump's ongoing crackdown on diversity programs and anti-LGBTQ policies led by Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida. Corporations have also pulled back on sponsorships for national LGBTQ groups like the Stonewall Museum, which began as a small collection in 1973. Named for the 1969 uprising in New York City, when a police raid at a Greenwich Village gay bar called the Stonewall Inn set off the modern gay rights movement. The 4,500 square foot space houses a collection of more than 30,000 books, including some banned at certain public schools, along with DVDs, historical documents, and artifacts that reflect the ongoing fight for equality. Organization officials say they are doing their best to keep the institution's doors open to preserve a repository for future generations, but it has been challenging. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. In federal and state funds, we are down 100%, Mr. Keston said about the cuts to its $1 million annual budget. Among the funding that has been cut off, he said, are grants of $10,000 to $25,000 that the organization received annually from both the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Federal Education Department. A $50,000 grant from the Florida State Department's Division of Arts and Culture, and annual grants of $25,000 to $50,000 from Florida Humanities, a nonprofit state affiliate of the NEH. In addition, Mr. Keston estimated that around $100,000 in corporate sponsorship funding had dried up. What has been worse for us is the demand of corporations to eliminate their DEI efforts, Mr. Keston said, referring to diversity, equality, and inclusion programs. We received multiple awards from various corporations. A few were considering or had agreed to join our board. Those contacts no longer return calls or texts. They no longer sponsor events. They have backed off joining the board. The NEA, which has been withdrawing grants to arts groups nationwide this year, said in a recent update to its grant guidelines that was shared with Stonewall that funding priority would be given to projects that celebrate and honor the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. The White House and the governor's office did not comment on the museum's funding shortfalls. The history of the LGBTQ rights movement is one of immense challenges, and museum officials said they might have the best resources to guide their survival, their own archives. Based on our archives and library, we have blueprints on how to fight back and to survive with less, and how to keep our community alive and rebuild as we have for generations, Mr. Keston said. Donations from individuals, including from the estates of deceased supporters, have helped Stonewall offset some of the losses. With our cautious spending, we are holding our own, but cautious not to take on more than we can, Mr. Keston said, adding that he has not filled three vacancies at the museum. Here are some of the more popular items in the archive. A Village People gold record. Stonewall is home to a framed gold record issued to the disco group Village People for selling more than 500,000 copies of their 1970 album Macho Man. The group was named after characters in gay clubs in Manhattan's West Village. Randy Jones, the group's cowboy, donated the gold record to Stonewall in 2015. Created in 1977, Village People found mainstream success with campy songs like YMCA. In the song's music video, members are dressed as American masculine archetypes, such as a cowboy, construction worker, police officer, soldier, and Native American. Despite the song's longtime association with the gay community, President Trump has embraced it and even joined Village People on stage in January for a sing-along. The Don't Ask, Don't Tell gavel. This was the gavel that Representative Nancy Pelosi, when she was the Speaker of the House, used when the chamber voted in 2010 to repeal the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, which prohibited gays and lesbians from openly serving in the U.S. military. Enacted by President Bill Clinton in 1993, the policy allowed gays to serve in the military as long as they kept their sexuality a secret. The foot-long gavel was donated to the archive by former Representative Barney Frank of Massachusetts, a longtime supporter of the LGBTQ community. Repealing the discriminatory Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy will honor the service and sacrifice of all those who dedicated their lives to protecting the American people, Ms. Pelosi said on the House floor in 2010. A tennis racket signed by Martina Navratilova. A red, white, and blue Bosworth racket signed by one of the most dominant players in tennis history is part of the collection at Stonewall and will be featured in an upcoming display of sports memorabilia from the museum's collection, Mr. Kisten said. Martina Navratilova, a Czech-American who played her first Wimbledon as a 16-year-old in 1973, won 18 Grand Slam singles championships. The archive also has her jacket from a Virginia Slims tournament and a signed ball. Fans of The Real Housewives of Miami may have seen Ms. Navratilova, 68, on the Bravo reality TV series because her wife, Julia Lemagova, is a cast member and cameras follow their relationship and expanded family. Ricky Martin's leather pants. The gay Puerto Rican pop star and actor started his career as a member of the boy band Menudo in the 1980s. As an adult, he became a successful solo artist who catapulted to meteoric level of fame with his hit song Livin' La Vida Loca. In 2010, Mr. Martin shared his private struggles with being gay in the public eye and becoming a father in his memoir, Me. Before Ricky Martin came out, it was that much more difficult for Latino men to come out and be gay, Mr. Keston said. The Marlin Beach Hotel sign. The 88-room Marlin Beach Hotel was a popular beach spot for gays in Fort Lauderdale for the second half of the 20th century. And its outdoor sign, which features a muscular man holding up a marlin, is kept at the museum. The hotel, which was built in 1954, was among the first large beach hotels that helped the city mature as a tourist resort, a panel at Stonewall reads. The archive includes the hotel's original blueprints as well as menus, news clippings, and advertisements in national gay magazines, which promoted the hotel as America's premier gay resort. The hotel was torn down in 1992 and is now an open-air mall. The shadow cast by these policies and the upending of the museum's funding model has increased the level of fear as the museum tries to stay afloat, Mr. Keston said. And yet, he added, it's always important to be where you're not wanted and to remind people that you exist. In Ashes of Amazon Fight, tensions emerge in huge bet on New York City housing. Years ago, progressives defeated a plan to build headquarters for Amazon in Queens. Now a new kind of development is gaining their support. When New York wanted to lure Amazon to Western Queens with more than $2 billion of public money in 2018, an ascendant left wing rallied to defeat it. Progressive politicians, headlined by Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, condemned the move as a corporate giveaway that would accelerate gentrification. 7 years later, a much bigger project is on the table. This time, it's not about granting hefty public subsidies to one of the biggest companies in the world. Instead, New York City is proposing a huge rezoning in the area that would allow private developers to construct almost 15,000 apartments across 54 blocks currently filled with warehouses and parking lots. A vote in the City Council is expected at the end of the month. The response from Zoran Mamdani, New York's progressive standard bearer and the Democratic nominee for mayor, has been unmistakably warm. I'm always excited about the prospect of building additional housing, Mr. Mamdani, who also represents the area in the state assembly, said during a recent interview with Errol Lewis on NY1. The contrast in tone from both Mr. Mamdani and the left more broadly reflects fundamental differences between the plans of 2018 and today. The Amazon effort, with the $1.7 billion in incentives from the state and hundreds of millions more from the city, was hatched by company executives and city and state officials. The new plan, in contrast, has followed 2 years of open negotiations among civic leaders, city officials, and residents, and puts a priority on benefits for New Yorkers like affordable housing and park space. But the shift also underscores how the left has increasingly changed its posture toward encouraging private development as a means to solve the city's housing crisis. It also highlights how Mr. Mamdani, a Democrat socialist, has a more nuanced position on addressing New York City's housing crisis that is often overshadowed by his uncomplicated pledge to freeze rents on rent-stabilized homes. In addition to the Long Island City plan, Mr. Mamdani has spoken favorably about Mayor Eric Adams' push to unleash development across the city, otherwise known as City of Yes. In an interview with the New York Times earlier this year, he said he now accepts that there is a very important role for the private sector to play in building homes, acknowledging that it was a position he did not previously embrace. He has spoken about finding ways to reduce insurance premiums for landlords and red tape for developers. I think he is generally a pro-development progressive, said Alicia Glenn, a deputy under former Mayor Bill de Blasio, who was involved in the negotiations with Amazon. You have been listening to a reading of articles and features from the October 7th issue of the New York Times. Your reader has been Barbara. Thank you for listening.